Sportsnet.com.
I was so pleased this hour of America tonight to be in New York City. And here we are at the UN, at the UNICEF facility. And Jocelyn Croes, who is the minister for Aruba in the U.S., sitting right by me now. I said to her, I want to be the minister of something, the minister of fun. And luckily she has a good sense of humor, so she smiled at me. But she has a serious message that we're going to talk about here on America Tonight, folks. Jocelyn, thanks so much for popping on America Tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's talk about what your mission is. It's very similar to what we're seeing happen in the United States with kids and obesity. And as somebody who's yo-yoed my whole life, you know, we grew up with Pop-Tarts sometimes.
They're good.
Yeah, and it wasn't always the fruit and the vegetables. You're seeing that there's obviously the same problem in Aruba and in other countries as well. So what is it what's your message? What are you trying to put out there?
Well, right at this moment in Aruba, it started the 8th. From the 8th to 11th, there's taking place the first Pan-American Conference on Obesity, mm-hmm. with a special focus on childhood obesity, organized by the government of Aruba in collaboration with the Pan-American Health Organization, which is the regional health organization for the Americas. And it's the conference, as I said, on obesity, which is special focus on childhood obesity. And basically, the conference is bringing together ministers of health, education, agriculture, and social development, and also a lot of well-renowned obesity experts in the region to present a united front in fighting this disease. And why? Well, as you just mentioned, United States of America has a big problem, so guess what? Aruba has higher rates of obesity than United States of America, and so does Mexico, and so do some other countries in the region. As a matter of fact, the Americas have the highest rate of overweight people in the world, with 50% of its population being overweight and 26% of the population in the Americas, so from Canada to Southern Cone, being overweight.
Wow, what do you attribute that too?
I think a lot of it, of course, it has different components, but we can't forget that the Americas went through a tremendous rate of urbanization in the last 30 years, and, well, maybe even longer, of course, and that has had a strong impact on change in lifestyles, just like we have here. You know, people are more sedentary. The foods we eat are less healthy, as you just mentioned. We think they're good, as I just joked about Pop-Tarts are good, is that it is. That's what it is that we are fed foods that we think are good from childhood. We eat them and we create a certain unhealthy habit in terms of eating, and that's what has happened. You know, people have moved to urban areas where they lead more sedentary lifestyles and where they consume foods that are starchy, that are sugary, that are cheap, and that are unhealthy. And this is the biggest problem. Obesity or overweight is a very simple correlation.
Yeah.
You eat the wrong food, you eat too many calories, you don't move, you gain weight.
Right.
No. So,
yeah, we all know about that, absolutely. So, and you mentioned this, not just Aruba, Barbados, you have a whole list of countries. You mentioned right. Canada, Brazil, Colombia, Mexico, and, of course, the United States as well. How do you make this, or how do you have this trickle down to the families? What do you do? What kind of a campaign do you do? As you know, Michelle Obama, Mrs. Obama, of course, that's her big thing. She just came out with the plate and, of course, more vegetables and fruits and smaller starches and whatnot. How do you trickle down that word to these other countries?
Well, it takes a comprehensive approach, you know, and that's why, as I mentioned, you have the ministers of health, education, agriculture, social development together with NGOs and industry. Why? Because this is not just a health issue. You know, for a very long time, as a matter of fact, in the Americas, it was always put as part of non-communicable diseases. If you keep it in the realm of non-communicable diseases only, you won't be able to involve all these other actors that have a strong impact on obesity. So what do you do? What's happening right now in Aruba is that they are coming up with a specific action plan for the Americas as a region That will be presented at the UN General Assembly in September as a action plan for the region, and that will be the declaration of, it will be called the Declaration of Aruba, and of course of great importance. Now, you just mentioned Barbados, Brazil, Canada, Colombia. Best practices of these countries are being presented now at the conference. Experts are presenting these. Colombia has an incredible best practice in getting its communities active in urban areas. They have the Ciclovia, which exists like for already about, I think, 20, 30 years, where they close up whole segments of the city to get families involved. It's a family activities, kids buy, families run, and what it is, it's a whole education process that people need to be moving together and do it together with your family, and it's an incredibly success story, and Aruba actually has taken it on as well as trying to adjust it to our own reality, of course, in getting people moving. And we have best practices from Brazil. Brazil has introduced an incredible project where they have eliminated commercials of food, of junk food, and sweet drinks during all children's programming.
You're kidding.
They have done that. On public television, Mexico has a best practice where they have eliminated the same thing, sugary foods and junk food in all public schools.
Wow.
Now, these are best practices that need to be shared with the region because they are bringing successes. And since the region has such a problem, that's why also we're sharing that. Another very important focus, actually, in this conference, and which I'm very happy to be able to talk to media here, is the fact that is looking at the role of the media in combating childhood obesity, because as well, not just in commercials, but in the way you talk about the issue, I think media has a very, we think media has a very important role in helping in combating childhood obesity across the region. So we'll be working with media from, you know, Canada to
all the way down
South America to see, to come with a plan of action on how you approach media. So that will be one of the results of the conferences in engaging media on combating this pandemic.
All right. We have to have some fun here, though, at the tail end of this.
Sure.
You are the minister for Aruba. That is an incredible country. I mean, that is all sun and fun and all. There are so many cool things to do in Aruba. And I know people right now are listening to this saying, Aruba. So what? Ultimately, what's the best part about your job, the fun part?
The fun part? Well, you know, it's people always ask me that, you know, what does Aruban's interest in the United States is, of course, great. First of all, you know, we have up to 1.5 million tourists a year, and 70% of which are from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very happy to have all the great American citizens.
Yeah, don't give them all those starches.
And that's the great fun of Aruba. You know, and in order to facilitate your travel, of course, I have to deal sometimes with the more boring stuff to make sure that, you know, you can continue pre-clearing immigration in Aruba instead of sending all these long lines in Miami, which I just experienced in flying over from El Salvador.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then I said, oh my God, this is really great that we have U.S. immigration pre-clearance in Aruba and that I don't have to do it here. I never realized what a privilege it was. So it's good to do. So my fun job, some part, is trying to, you know, of course, promote Aruba in a great way. But I must admit that a lot of my job is very serious, you know, because as you know, Aruba is also, strategically located. I work on economic development, economic promotion, you know, on peace and security issues. So unfortunately, I must say that not the biggest part of my job is really just fun.
Right, that's the other stuff.
It's the other serious stuff, which
Minister
we have
for
to do.
Minister for Aruba, thank you so much. Oh,
thank you for having me.
Appreciate
really
it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Have you ever heard of a pharmacist who discourages the use of most prescription drugs? Well, pharmacist Ben Fuchs is that person, and boy, is he fascinating. He's a nutritional pharmacist and skincare specialist who operates out of Boulder, Colorado, and to hear this man speak is nothing less than inspiring because he's charismatic and makes a lot of sense. He asks, why take dangerous drugs when all your body needs to stay healthy is all natural with no side effects? Pharmacist Ben sees the human body as a healing and regenerating system, divinely designed to heal and renew itself on a moment-to-moment basis. but it needs nutrition and nutritional supplementation. Ben says you've got to be on a nutritional supplement program if you want to be healthy in 21st century America, and he wants to help people get off the toxic drug treadmill and get on a good nutritional supplement program. I support what pharmacist Ben is saying and doing to help America get healthier, and I urge you to watch and listen to Ben deliver his powerful message at your convenience. Just go to AmericaTonightTeam.com. That's AmericaTonightTeam.com.
As many people know, ever since President Nixon took us off the gold standard, the U.S. dollar has been devaluating. What people don't know, however, is how this directly affects your personal finances. Is there a way to protect your portfolios from losing value? The answer to all of this is gold and silver. They both have maintained their purchasing power for 6,000 years. If you had $100,000 in cash and $100,000 in gold and silver back in 1913 and kept them until now, your cash would have the buying power of only $4,800. But your gold and silver would have the buying power of $3 million. The answer to protecting your assets is simple. Call John Ballman today at 1-800-686-2237, extension 169. Get all your questions answered before your money is worth zero. Call 1-800-686-2237, extension 169. Take action today while we still accept paper dollars for gold. That's 1-800-686-2237, extension 169.
Did you know that billions are spent every year just for a simple drink of water? But it's the quality of the water that Americans are concerned with, especially after floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, and other disasters that routinely disrupt and contaminate water supplies. Safe drinking water is too important to leave to chance. That's why you need an AquaRain water filtration system. The American-made AquaRain is an essential survival tool that operates for just pennies per gallon. It lets you retrieve water from lakes, ponds, streams, or rooftops during any disaster and assures you of healthy drinking water. The stainless steel AquaRain's patented space-age ceramic and GAC technology uses microfiltration and gravity to purify water. No chemicals, no electricity, no water pressure needed. And AquaRain's cartridges last for thousands of gallons. AquaRain is hands down the best water filter on the market. Call 800-572-2051 or go to aquarain.com. That's 800-572-2051 or aquarain.com. Every family needs an AquaRain.
Better than I know myself, so I'm gonna let her do all the talking.
Ooh-hoo.
Ooh-hoo. I came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree.
Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo.
Welcome back to America Tonight with me, Kate Delaney. So proud to be in New York City and here at the United Nations. Actually, we're off in a special UNICEF area, and it's a very, 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 I'm going to say this 10 times, big day. As many of you know, I did a lot of work as far as my television career on AIDS and the epidemic, and I'm very proud of some of the stuff that we were able to uncover then. And now here we are. We have 30 heads of state at the UN talking about AIDS, and we have Jimmy Kolker sitting right here with me. He's the chief of the HIV AIDS program division. He's the man. Jimmy, thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it. We know you are swamped today with all the people that are in town.
Well, it's great to be here, and thanks for your interest in AIDS and in UNICEF and the UN.
Let's start off with just an umbrella question that, you know, we broadcast all over the United States, and AIDS affects and touches so many people in different ways. Where are we as far as battling the epidemic? What's happened? Now it's been decades. I think somehow, sometimes it gets lost.
One of the reasons we have this high-level meeting in New York this week is that it's the 30th anniversary of the discovery of the HIV virus, or identification of the virus. And of course, there's been remarkable progress in that there now are drugs which make AIDS, while still not a curable disease, it is treatable, and of course it's preventable. And we know a lot more about how the virus behaves and how it's transmitted. And from the point of view of children and AIDS, it's very rare now that a child would be born HIV positive, but in the first world, but in Africa, there's still 1,000 children a day who are acquiring the infection as newborns. So In the U.S. itself, there are over 1 million people who are living with HIV, and that number has not gone down significantly over time. And so the good news is many of them are kept alive because the drug regimens are readily available, but there still are new cases in the U.S., and there are over 33 million people worldwide who are living with AIDS.
So there's still the need for speed. So you have these heads of state in, and you want to utilize that time. What are some of the things that you talk about when you hit the pedal to the metal, when they hit the door? What are you talking about?
Well, one is the vertical transmission from mothers to children, is something we want to eliminate. It's, as I say, it's a rare occurrence in the first world because we know what to do to prevent this transmission. There are drugs that are readily available. In every country, there is a program of preventing mother-to-child transmission, but we reached only about half of the women in need. So the huge priority, and there'll be a plan introduced by the Secretary General, President Bill Clinton, UNAIDS, along with UNICEF, our Executive Director Anthony Lake and others this afternoon, that talks about what we need to do by 2015 to reduce the number of new pediatric infections by 90%. And we have the technology to do that. There is scale-up in every country, but there are many, many women who would benefit for their own health from getting this treatment but who aren't getting it right now.
Is it part of it? Is it the lack of knowledge of knowing where they can get the treatment? You mentioned Africa, of course, which has always been ground zero.
Right. The majority of people who are HIV positive in the world don't know their status. And so clearly testing is a key entry point to getting on care and treatment. But also we have now very effective drugs, much more effective than they were even 5 or 6 years ago in terms of helping to prevent vertical transmission and prevent infection among discordant couples where one partner is positive but the other is uninfected, and keeping that partner safe as well.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned at the top, you're the chief of HIV AIDS program division. Explain that, flesh that out for us, for the audience, because, you know, titles, and it's great to have titles, and you're proud, I'm sure, of yours, but what does that actually mean? What is your job at the UN?
Well, I'm in UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, and the program division of UNICEF, which is our country programs, most of it done in over 160 countries around the world, we have four focus areas. One is child survival, child protection, education, but the other one is HIV and AIDS. And so the priorities for UNICEF in terms of children and AIDS is to keep children from being invisible, which they often are, but to scale up not only preventing new infections in young people through mother-to-child transmission, but also pediatric treatment. Even just 6-7 years ago, it cost $20,000 a year to treat a child because you had to essentially custom make the drugs. Mm-hmm. Now they're readily available fixed-dose drugs, combination therapy, costs less than $200 a year to keep that child alive. So the pediatric treatment, then protection for orphans and vulnerable children. More than 16 million kids living today have lost a parent to AIDS, and so those children have special needs. UNICEF is trying to address those clearly at a family and community level. And finally, prevention among young people and adolescents. That is going to be the key if we're ever going to reverse the epidemic. We're making progress, but not enough. The UN had set a goal in 2001 of reducing infections among young people by 25%. Since 2001, they've been reduced by 12%, which is progress, but we haven't even met the goal of a 25% reduction, and we need to do even better than that. AIDS is a preventable disease, and we need to be sure that young people are equipped and empowered to prevent new infections.
So we talked about the money, and that's amazing, $20,000 to $200
factor
to treat
of 100.
It.
That's
incredible, so significant. Is it, besides the knowledge and getting the testing, is some of it money? Is it some of it still getting donations?
Working with the drug companies to reduce the price of the medication, getting generic versions of the medications, and especially getting pediatric formulas, because many of the tests of new drugs are just done on adults, and it takes years then to adapt those to be sure that they're safe for children. So there's a lot of sort of upstream work that needs to be done as well. But clearly an investment in prevention means that you save tens of thousands of dollars in terms of treatment costs if each infection prevented. But the whole dynamic of what are smart investments in terms of AIDS, and the moral imperative of keeping people who do have HIV alive, because we have that technology. We're doing it in this country, in the United States, but we need to give other people around the world that same opportunity.
Yeah. Looking at your background, I mean, you've got an incredible career, certainly in politics, I'll say. You were a U.S. ambassador to Uganda. You spent some time in Zimbabwe, Mozambique. Did that pique the interest for you to go in this direction to solve the problem, or
well,
no?
Well, it was quite a change for me, because I'm a career diplomat. I was in the Foreign Service. I worked at 8 U.S. embassies abroad. I got to be a U.S. ambassador twice, once appointed by President Clinton, once by President Bush. But it was in Uganda where I saw the difference that an AIDS program could make. The President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which we launched there, and Uganda was the largest program, and I, through no merit or virtue of mine, I was head of the largest AIDS program in the world for 2 or 3 years. And seeing the tens of thousands of people who were first time able to access treatment, seeing them alive, seeing them healthy, seeing them contributing instead of wasting away, was such a life-changing experience that when I left Uganda, I said, this is something I want to be involved in. And I became number 3 in the U.S. government's international AIDS program for 2 years. And then I was offered the job to head the AIDS program at UNICEF. And it's been a remarkable change of career for me, but something that I really feel is making a difference.
What's been the most rewarding thing? Is it because you're making a difference, or what is it for you that is so rewarding about this job?
Absolutely. We know how to prevent HIV. We know how to treat HIV, but getting the, you know, we have the science, we have the economic data, but as a diplomat, what I saw was missing was, where's the public policy aspect of this? How do we make this a priority? How do we make this fit in with everything else that governments are doing? And that's true, that's a challenge for the U.S. government, but it's even more of a challenge for African governments, where sometimes AIDS is very taboo, where the health systems are weak. And it really has been, for me, an opportunity to put all of that experience that I had in Africa and in Europe and working for the U.S. government to the test of saying, how can we actually make lives better for children? Because we know what to do. We just have to get the political systems, the health systems, and the distribution systems to work together to make lives for children much better.
Yeah, no kidding. One last one, Jimmy. This is big because you're speaking to a national audience. Mm-hmm. What can the people in Iowa do, Illinois, Connecticut, New York, Texas, what can they do? Is there something they can do to keep the awareness up of this battle?
Well, absolutely. There are more than 1 million HIV-positive people in the United States, and reducing stigma, talking about AIDS, realizing that this is still very much a problem throughout the world, not just in Africa, but all over, is important. And I grew up in the Midwest, and I realized that this is something that in your own communities, the sense of international engagement is still very strong in the United States. And I'm really pleased, working for UNICEF, that UNICEF has been able to mobilize groups in the U.S. to contribute to our work, but also to be aware of what UNICEF is doing and the difference that we're making in the lives of children. So UNICEFUSA.org, UNICEF.org are two very good sites to check on what activities are going on and how people can make a difference.
Yeah. Jimmy Coker, I can tell you're making a difference. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the opportunity and your interest in this topic.
Thanks.
Fellas, are you looking to spice things up in the bedroom? Been fantasizing about surprising your lover with an adventurous new toy or adult movie? Well, here's an offer you won't be able to resist. Go to adamandeve.com, and for a limited time only, you'll get 50% off just about any item. But that's not all. Oh, no. When you select your one item at 50% off, you'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs for a little inspiration. Plus, a free extra gift so sensual, we can't mention it on the radio. And to top it all off, we'll even throw in free shipping on your entire order. And no, we're not teasing. So check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Get 50% off one item when you type DEAL21 for the offer code upon checkout. When you do, you'll get 3 free DVDs, a free extra gift, and free shipping. Just use offer code DEAL21 at adamandeve.com.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
The American people think they live in a constitutional republic, land of the free, home of the brave.
right.
Just try those lines on the judge when you get a ticket or have to deal with a big bad IRS.
Instead, use EscapeHarassment.com. Since 1972, our volunteer group of researchers and educators have successfully taught how to escape tickets by law, and it works. Escape Harassment has three different steps to follow, depending on where you are in the ticket process. Learn how to escape tickets, IRS, or court proceedings before you go to court. For free, three-minute pre-recorded information and FAQs, call this toll-free number, 1-877-457-9009. That's 877-457-9009. Or go to EscapeHarassment.com and see our money-back guarantee. That's EscapeHarassment.com. Remember, Escape Harassment works.
If you owe money to the IRS, you can't make the problem go away by yourself. But with the help of Dan Pilla, you can get your problem solved once and for all.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. For 30 years, I've helped thousands of people solve their tax debt problem, and I can help you solve yours, too. We take a very simple but proven three-step approach to solving your problem. First, we stabilize IRS collection actions so you don't have to worry about the IRS seizing your bank account or paycheck. Next, we build a comprehensive plan to get your tax debt reduced to the fullest extent possible, sometimes even completely eliminated. And finally, we work with you every step of the way to get your problem solved once and for all. Call us for a free consultation. Call 1-800-346-6829. We'll work together to get your problem solved guaranteed.
Dan Pilla has been protecting taxpayers from the IRS for three decades, and he can help you too. Call us today at 800-346-6829. That's 800-34-NO-TAX.
9 years, thousands of clients worldwide, amazing results. And here's more proof of the effectiveness of how Heart and Body Extract supports good circulation and healthy arterial flow.
My name is Crystal. I'm a 45-year-old and live in Houston, Texas. I was diagnosed with having mitral valve prolapse 10 years ago. My cardiologist said surgery and drugs was the only thing he could offer me.
What did Crystal do?
I ordered Heart and Body Extract in August 2006. When I first took my first 15 drops, I embraced the formula and could even feel the goodness of the formula starting to work.
Clean, clear arteries are happy arteries after using Heart and Body Extract. Learn more at hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305. That's hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305. HB Extract comes with a 100% ironclad money-back guarantee. Details at hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305 for Heart and Body Extract.
Once again, we're broadcasting live, just a stone's throw away from the mothership, the UN. We're at the UNICEF facility, and what a pleasure, what an honor, really, to welcome to the show Kiyo Akasaka, and he is, listen to this title, this is like the equivalent of a cabinet member, just to give you the sense of who Kiyo is. He's the Undersecretary General for Communications and Public Information. That means he knows everything, or at least a little bit, about everything that goes on at the UN.
Yes.
Kiyo, thanks so much. We appreciate it. Let's start with a couple of things. Let's talk about the humanitarian side of the UN in a couple of different places. First of all, Haiti. I mean, when Haiti happened, everybody opened up their wallets. Even if they had $3, they were given $3. But what's happened now? What's the situation like, and what's the UN's role in what's going on the ground in Haiti?
There are very many things which the United Nations has been doing in Haiti. Humanitarian aid, yes, and security and protection of the people by our peacekeeping forces. We have lost more than 100 staff as well. It was a tragedy for the United Nations as well. We would like to make sure that all the money given to the United Nations and to for the help of the people and the reconstruction of the economy of Haiti be ensured. And so our peacekeeping forces in Haiti, as well as our humanitarian aid workers, have been working every day to help reconstruct the lives of the Haitian people. We have had the outbreak of cholera. I believe that the current state of cholera can be said under control, but a lot of people have lost their lives. And the WHO World Health Organization people, the UNICEF people, the people from other United Nations family members have been working day and night to help the people. And I believe that the things are getting slowly but steadily getting better.
When you go into a country and you assess it, and you went through everything for us there, you went through what's going on with the cholera and security and the needs of the people there, do you just, you're on the ground, the peacekeeping people are in place, they assess what's happening, and then if you have to assign more people, then do you do re-rack that? How do you determine that? Do you just set up timelines as you go through and you just cross your fingers and hope for the best as you're digging through this? How long do you think the UN will be involved in Haiti?
Well, it depends. In the case of the peacekeeping forces, they are meant to protect the civilians. With the better security, they are patrolling the cities and towns and to make sure that the people's lives are safe. But as far as the construction work or caring about people in needs and hospitals and all that, we need a lot of partners from NGOs, from local community, and they have been mobilized by our people from WHO, UNICEF, and UN Population Funds and other programs. Yes, we are working with the local people, and UN has been hiring quite a lot of people too. And some of the programs, like the International Labour Organization's work, is to combine the health as well as the employment. You employ the unemployed people for the job, for the clearance of the debris and reconstruct the roads and cities. Then you can get the employment for the people who have suffered from the earthquake.
To help them get back on their feet.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Kio Akasaka, again, a real thrill for us, Undersecretary General for Communications and Public Information. Kio, we were just talking about Haiti. What about the humanitarian side in Libya? A little bit different. Muammar Gaddafi's dug in. There seems to be what I'll call a stalemate there. What do you do when you're in the middle of that situation versus Haiti?
We have been having a very difficult time in helping the people in Libya from attacks from the government forces. There have been lots of people who have been fleeing from Tripoli, and our humanitarian assistance has been going on in many cities. They have been braving their lives to help the people. This is a dangerous situation. But yes, the humanitarian assessment team went to see what needs are great, and our Organization for Humanitarian Work has been Office of the Coordination of the Humanitarian Work has been on the ground to help the people, particularly in refugee camps or borders where people are fleeing from the conflict zones.
In talking so much here about the humanitarian side and the peacekeepers and whatnot, what is the profile of someone? I mean, who are the peacekeepers? Are they people in their 20s and 30s? I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of at a loss of, I'm trying to get a description for the people listening as to who those people are. How would you describe them?
We have currently more than 110,000 peacekeepers deployed in 15 places 15 countries, and many of them are from these member countries. They are soldiers or civilians or police people, policemen, policewomen from member states, and countries like India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. They are traditionally the main peacekeepers of the United Nations. They are troops providers of the United Nations peacekeeping forces.
Where do you think, we mentioned some hot spots for two different reasons, but where do you think the greatest need is?
Currently, we see a greater need in Sudan. Southern Sudan has voted for independence, and they are going to have the inauguration of the new country on July the 9th. Mm-hmm. Very soon, in 1 month. But the conflicts still re-erupted, and we need the forces to keep the order, law and order there. Also, we have the operation in Democratic Republic of Congo. We have operations in Sudan, Darfur of Sudan again. Yes, there are lots of the hot spots in Africa. But not only in Africa, we also have peacekeeping forces in the Middle East and in other places as well.
Do you, in your job, I mean, obviously, because it umbrellas so much and so many different issues, do you find, it's like you're talking here about 15 different places, do you personally have to, will you go and visit, will you do that, as, or are you, you know, is New York ground zero for you and you try to keep here as close to the UN as you can to try to strategize?
Well, I don't, actually. The peacekeeping forces in 15 places
Sure.
have their own communication offices. They have their own spokespersons.
Mm-hmm.
So we coordinate. We help each other. But they have their own independent communication units. In most of the United Nations entities, we have the communication officers
on the ground in
on
every
the
place.
Ground as well.
And right. So you may go and visit. You might
yeah.
go to the Sudan
exactly.
to see the situation, but it's not a necessity, which is what I assumed, because
right.
you're coordinating from
right.
From the UN, obviously.
Yeah. We are not a big department, as you might think, because we have just about 750 staff in our department, and 300 officers in our communication centers, information centers, in 63 places in the world.
Did you ever think, I was in looking at your background, you were Japan's ambassador to the UN, you have an amazing resume where you've done a slew of different things. You were the Deputy Director General of the Japanese Foreign Ministry Multilateral Cooperation Department. That's a mouthful.
And, big names.
Exactly. And so, and Kyoto, you were part of that, the conference there. Did you? What led you to the UN?
Well, I have been working for long years in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan, and that's why I have been involved in many UN-related issues like climate change or development and human rights issues. And when the current Secretary General, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, became Secretary General in 2007, I was lucky to be selected for the current post. It has been a difficult year for the last 4 years, but I'm glad that we have been making some important progress.
It sounds like you like your job, and it sounds like you're out there digging the trenches as best you can, right?
Well, I do whatever I can do, but it is increasingly difficult because we have got to use new technologies. We are using increasingly social media, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that the listeners will look at the United Nations YouTube program.
There you go.
Very good music programs.
YouTube.
Yes.
Yep.
YouTube. And please join us as our friends on Facebook.
Perfect way to end this.
Will I have garlic breath after I take Ali-C?
We get that question all the time about the world's best garlic extract, Ali-C. And the answer is, Ali-C contains stabilized allicin, nature's antimicrobial agent, and the active ingredient in crushed garlic, but will not give you garlic breath. Scientifically proven in double-blind studies, using low doses of allicin greatly reduces the number, severity, and duration of common colds. Our powerful Ali-C contains 300 milligrams of stabilized allicin. Just one tablet of Ali-C is equivalent to 40 garlic cloves. It's effective against asthma, MRSA, bacterial, fungal, and viral infections, and helps lower high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Plus, it's a natural mosquito repellent. Boost resistance to infection with nature's best garlic extract, Ali-C. For more information and to order Ali-C, call 877-888-7126 or go to garlichealthproducts.com. That's 877-888-7126 or garlichealthproducts.com. Fight back with Ali-C.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
How would you like to rev up your metabolism and energy while lifting your spirits? Now a new healthy tea is available that will do just that, and it's called Zoom Tea. Zoom Tea was developed for a former welterweight boxing champion to increase his energy and focus in the ring. Zoom Tea is an alternative healthy pick-me-up that can replace coffee, common tea, or soda. Zoom Tea also helps remove radiation from the body, promotes weight loss, and is high in antioxidants. For a limited time, get our introductory price for a 1-month supply of this amazing tea for just $20, or a 2-month supply for only $35, and we'll pay the shipping and handling. Go to our website now and start feeling the healthy and energizing benefits from drinking Zoom Tea. Go to ZoomTea.com. That's ZoomTea.com. Or call toll-free 877-341-4769. 877-341-4769 today.
All right, we're coming up on the tail end of the hour here on America Tonight, and Sandra Macharia is with us, and we're going to talk some Sudan with her. Sandra is a communication specialist with the United Nations Development Program, of course, here in New York, and that's where we're broadcasting from. Sandra, as you can imagine, the Sudan, and you know, the Sudan is a red-hot issue with so many people, and I'm wondering now, because I have friends that are trying to do something, trying to help, has the level of awareness of what's going on in the Sudan really been raised? Are people aware of what it's like in the Sudan with the unrest?
Well, first, thank you. It's good to meet you. I think that, indeed, the whole story about Sudan this year, it is one of the largest stories of this year and one of the huge concerns of this year as well. I mean, the Secretary General has said that, you know, Sudan is one of the big things for the UN. And I just need to sort of make a distinction between what's going on in the north and what's going on in the south and Darfur. I mean,
please,
it's
do
a huge country. I mean, it's the largest country on the continent of Africa, which most people actually don't even know. And so I spent some time in southern Sudan, which is where they had the referendum in January. And what's happening there actually now is very exciting. I mean, they got to vote in January whether they wanted to remain united with the north or create their own state. And they voted overwhelmingly for their own state. And so they will be building a country from scratch. They're working on it now, and in July they will be celebrating their independence. And they are definitely going to need a lot more attention, I believe. I think they're going to need a lot of help, because some of the things that I think we would take for granted in the U.S. about how the government functions, about the kinds of services it can provide for you in terms of healthcare and education and even infrastructure, roads, transport, they don't have that. They don't have that. And so a lot of governments are very involved in Southern Sudan right now, trying to support them with their goals and with the construction. But it's going to take some time, and I think we all just have an obligation to remain engaged.
You were there. Were you there for the referendum when that was going down?
I was there just until before the referendum. So I was there for 5 weeks until the middle of December, and the vote was in January.
What was that like, that lead up to this, to getting the vote? It had to be huge.
It was amazing. At a personal level, as a UNDP worker level, it was the most amazing experience, professional experience I have had. For different things. The first was that I'm Kenyan, and Kenya is right next door. And so this is a story that I've known ever since I was a child. You know, Southern Sudan, we've had lots of refugees in the country.
Yeah.
A lot of the aid support for Southern Sudan was out of northern Kenya. And so this is a story that I've had since my childhood. And then to be part of UNDP, working in Southern Sudan, where one of the main things that we're doing in support of the Southern Sudanese people was to manage what's called a donor basket fund, where lots of different countries would put money to support this process. And what that money does is to buy the ballot papers, to help registration, to do civic education, to let people know this is the referendum, this is what these are the options, what do you want to do, and to fly the ballot papers along with the peacekeeping mission to these very remote parts of the region. It was fantastic.
And when you're saying remote, you're saying villages that were just way off the map, basically, right?
Places where you have to fly to.
Ooh.
Where you hire, you get sort of these 4x4 cars and commercial trucks and donkeys and whatever it took to get the ballot papers out there and to get the registration papers out there, we did it. We did it.
So you weren't there for the vote, but I remember this. The vote was, we're talking pretty smooth as far as getting everybody out and about, right?
Yes.
It was pretty easy.
It went very well. I know in the run-up to that, reading in the press and all of that, there were a lot of people that didn't think it would go so well. The Southern Sudanese were amazing. I mean, they put so much work into the groundwork, and they turned out. It wasn't violent at all, and the vote was over. It was over 90%
to separate to have their own country.
Yeah. But it was peaceful. It was wonderful.
And now they move forward and have to do, as you said, start from scratch, as we did as a nation how many hundreds of years ago,
yeah,
that we always talk about. And so now they get to just draw it up. Do you stay involved in that to try to help with infrastructure, all that stuff, to help them, because they need, the people I'm sure would need help on how to organize the government?
Oh, sure. I mean, we're very present, and not just us. I mean, the U.S., for instance, is there. I mean, a lot of other agencies are there, UNICEF, WFP, all of them, our colleagues over at the peacekeeping mission. And, I mean, we're all very, very engaged with this process. It's a priority for us and for the Southern Sudanese, and we respond to that. And on UNDP's part, a lot of the work that we're doing now is around what we call capacity building for the government, which is basically helping them get tap into the expertise in the region to sort of help out in the government. So how to write a budget, how to work it out, how to prioritize funding, how to put together development plans, all of these kinds of things that you need to run a state.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. I mean, I can just see it in your... This is radio, folks, but you should just see Sandra's face. It's just beaming. And I like the correlation of saying, you know, you're Kenyan, you grew up, you heard the stories, you saw the refugees, and now you've come full circle,
yeah,
even in to help and to get those ballots out.
Yeah.
What about... So that's happening in the South. What about in the North?
So in the North, UNDP also works in the North. And how we work is that we work with governments and communities on what their priorities are, right? So for some countries, it's, adapting to climate change or HIV and AIDS, for instance. Mm-hmm. So they ask us to come in and help them prioritize around these things and put in place a plan. And so in the north, we're working a lot with the government there around its own priorities. And I know that some of those are related to poverty reduction and recovery after the war and those kinds of things. So those are the kinds of things that we would be doing there as well.
Yeah, as you said, you're talking about the biggest country in Africa, on that continent, the Sudan. So that has to be one of the things that you always have to tackle, right? We're talking about planes, trains, automobiles, any way you can get there. It is difficult to maneuver, right, around the Sudan.
I mean, they say somewhere like southern Sudan is England and France combined. I mean, it boggles my mind even what that means in terms of size.
Right.
And then when they say something that they have about 150 kilometers of road in that amount of space, of paved road. So it's just mind-boggling to me. And parts when it rains and there's floods, there are parts of the country of the region that are just inaccessible.
Right.
You cannot go there.
Yeah.
So it's,
you have to figure a way. That's what you do, right?
Yeah, you figure it out. And those are the kinds of challenges that I think people need to appreciate. When they read the press, they just think, oh, one, two, three, and it's a linear progression, and it's not.
Right.
You struggle and you try, and then sometimes you fail, and then you try again. And
sure.
Because you can't just say no and leave.
Yeah. What would you tell the, because we're a nationally syndicated show, so there's people listening to us, Sandra, that are in the middle of the Midwest, in Ottumwa, Iowa, or in Illinois, or in Columbia, Missouri. There's people in Connecticut, people in Vermont listening, people in the great state of Texas listening, in Dallas and Austin. What would you tell them the biggest maybe misconception is about the Sudan, besides its size? I don't think people really understand. I don't think they really understand the region.
I think the largest misconception about Sudan, and I guess Africa in general, is that they're just waiting for help. I think that is the greatest misconception. I mean, I am African, so I go home. My parents live there. My family lives there. And there's an amazing energy on the continent. I mean, there's this whole narrative you have in the press and in some places that it's a hopeless continent, that nothing is going on, and it's not true. You know, we have a huge youth population that is on cell phones, that is on Facebook, that is tweeting, that is doing all of this kind of stuff. They're going into their own businesses. There's an energy there that is just unleashing, and people are doing things. It's exciting. And now with the internet, with phones, with travel, go and see for yourself. Go and see. Talk to people. You know, I think that these are sort of artificial barriers to just create misunderstandings around people. But at the end of the day, they're people just like you. They're in Missouri,
sure,
and they're in Connecticut. People who just want a good life for their kids.
Right.
Want a decent standard of living for themselves.
Yeah.
To take care of their business. That's what they want. They're not any different than that.
And kids are kids. I mean, I saw that when I went to Ecuador and I've traveled around. They don't know. It doesn't, you know, I'm sure it's exciting. You get stuff. You get opportunities. Yeah. But it's not about the stuff. It's about the people, I think.
Exactly. And I know that, I mean, and it's really sad, some of the stuff that's going on here with the flooding and the, you know, I mean, it's sad, but it goes to also show that they're suffering here, they're suffering there.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all people at the end of the day, and we just help each other out and listen to each other's stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a delight talking to you. I can tell you love your job. You are my favorite guest.
Oh,
Sandra
Machado,
thanks so much, and continued success.
Thank you. Thank you for
having
me.
Thanks for joining us on America Tonight.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks, that was good stuff.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
thanks.
That's good stuff. I'm supposed to take a trip to Kenya. I think I'm taking it in 8 months.